Will you do me a favor? Just take a minute and reflect on the people that have had the biggest impact on your life and who you became. I'm willing to bet that if you think about that even just for a minute, one of your teachers from childhood will come to mind. Today on 50 Fires, I had the pleasure of speaking with Jonathan Santos Silva. Jonathan is a school teacher, a community organizer, and an advocate for educators all over the world.
My mom used to always tell me, to whom much is given, much is required. She didn't say to me, work hard, get a safe job, or make a lot of money. And so it was part of my programming that like, okay, so what are you going to do with all of that? How will you serve?
We talk about the tension that is often involved when your occupation is something that you feel called to do. We also touch on the importance of community and break down this myth of the self-made individual.
Nobody's self-made, right? Like there are so many people who had to be complicit in your arrival.
That's coming up today on 50 Fires.
Blind Nil Audio.
Greetings, Carl here. My guest, Jonathan Santos Silva, got his start as an educator in 2010 at Little Wound School on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota as part of the Teach for America program. He taught secondary math and also called play-by-play for the school's athletic program. That experience led him to his next calling by founding the Liber Institute, an organization focused on developing the leadership capacity of Indigenous students, families, and educators from all over the country, helping them to ultimately transform the schools and the communities that they serve. I discovered Jonathan through a podcast that he hosts called Changing Course, produced by Teach for America, and found his insights and storytelling skills to be so compelling that I knew we could have a really unique and insightful conversation about money and meaning. So let's dive right into it. I'm Carl Richards, an author, artist, and certified financial planner. And today we're talking about money with Jonathan Santos Silva. This is 50 Fires, a podcast about money and meaning. Hi, Jonathan. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you, Carl?
Good. So this is really meant to be like if you and I were together just sitting around the campfire, having a little chat,
right?
You know what I mean? I'm just really curious about a couple of things I'm super curious about. One is your own personal experience with money and then what you've learned through the work you've done. So let's start with the decision that you made back in 2010 to enter I think it's fair to say, a notoriously underpaid profession.
Oh yeah.
Of teaching. And not only that, you did it in a notoriously underpaid sector, you know, nonprofit. Was that a conscious decision? Did you know, right, that there was not huge upside financially to the career choice?
I did know. And from a young age, just to kind of set it up, like my mom used to always tell me, to whom much is given, much is required, which is a paraphrase of scripture. And I grew up in a great church. It was this Catholic church on the south side of Brockton, Massachusetts, you know, the shoe city, the city of champs, you know. She didn't say to me, you know, work hard, get a safe job, or make a lot of money, change the world. Like, she didn't say any of the, it was to whom much is given, much is required. And I don't know if, I don't think she said that to all of my siblings, right? I think she probably had special things she said to each of us, but that was for whatever reason. What she said to me. And so I grew up really young feeling like I have been given a lot. I am so fortunate. I have great parents. I have great siblings. I have great aunts and uncles and grandparents and like this amazing life. My mom used to tell me that my library card was my passport. So like I could go to the library, I could read about anything. I see the world through my books. Like I had this amazing childhood. And so like I think it was natural. It was part of my programming that like, okay, so what are you going to do with all of that? How will you serve? You know, how are you going to show up in this world and pay forward what is required, right? What is required? And so I didn't know what it was. I went to school, you know, I went to undergrad at Northeastern University. I got my degree in business. I thought I was going to start a company or a business or something. But as I went into the corporate world, it didn't feel right. I had great jobs. I worked in great companies. They're all great companies. So I named them, people recognize them. I didn't feel like it was it. And so then when I met my wife, my future wife, just was wonderful woman. And my wife was like, maybe you're a lawyer. Maybe you're, I don't know, but there's something in you. And so around that time, I found Teach for America. And that's how I ended up in Pine Ridge. And it just felt like it started answering a lot of that question. How am I going to give back? So when I start reading about South Dakota, as I'm going through the process and I'm reading that like 100% of teachers are on reservations, that really struck me in a spiritual level. So then I start asking more questions and then I get placed there. And then I didn't know what I was going to teach. I had wanted to teach history maybe or elementary school. And then I remember talking to the folks in the process and they're like, you know, math is a great need in South Dakota. And algebra one, if kids don't get algebra one the first time, there's all these indicators for the future, right? If kids don't get algebra one early enough, and if they don't pass it early enough, it takes them off track for so many things associated with college. And I get placed in Kyle, South Dakota at Little Wound School, and I'm the algebra one teacher. Like, it just felt like, I was like, whoa, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. So the fact that I made $30,000, that never was like, you know, I never go, why am I only making 30 grand? Huh. I am educating people's kids. They're giving me their kids. This is a great responsibility. Don't you think they should not only pay me more, but they should train me more? They should invest in us more. They should give us more resources. Never thought about it. I look at it now, especially now that I'm not in the classroom now and I'm in a role where I'm supporting educators. I'm a vocal proponent that we should pay teachers more. We should train them better. We should equip them with better tools and resources. We should change the way schools look. We should invest more and talk about putting more money in schools to make them places that kids want to be, right? Isn't it a daggone shame that kids, not all kids, but especially middle school, by the time middle school and high school, kids are like dragging their feet into the building, but they are booking it out.
Yeah.
Right? When you think about like what education is supposed to be, we're supposed to be drawing out of our young people who they are. And that's what education means too, right? It's to draw out, not to fill a bucket, but to draw out. At the essence, we're curious beings. And so why shouldn't kids be running into the place where like there's this cadre of adults who are trained in nothing more than to help you draw out your purpose and to draw out who you are and to make sense and meaning of the world? They should be running into that place and be like, your parents had to drag you out, but it's not, because so much of education, we have not boiled it down to the essence of what is best for our kids. We've built it into, how do we prepare them to be automatons, to get into this economy and to contribute and to pay taxes and not make too much of a fuss, right? Stay on the straight and narrow, contribute your portion. Don't even care if you vote, just as long as you pay taxes. Like, that is such a, we're missing out.
Totally. Yeah. I know a lot of people that have jobs that they're relative to other occupations, I feel like they're underpaid, but they're really passionate jobs. You know, like I think of my friends that are ski patrol, you know, that are trained paramedics, know how to handle explosives. You know, they're keeping you alive at a ski resort and they're getting paid $25 an hour if they're lucky. I think about my friends that are like maybe a river guide or any of the nonprofit friends. There have to be financial pressures occasionally, especially in those places where you've made a conscious decision to say, hey, I'm not going to focus on that. I'm going to focus on this thing I feel called to do. When those pressures come up, how do you remind yourself of like, I'm going to set that want aside, or maybe that would be nice? Or is it literally just not a thing for you?
I mean, first and foremost, what I would say is it feels like such a mind screw, and it's a bunch of mind trash that folks want us to hold on to. This idea that when you do work that has purpose, that you shouldn't be rewarded. And I'm not saying that's what you were saying, but I'm just saying like, it is a part of the—
Right, like it has to come with sacrifice.
Right, like, you know, like it just makes, to me, very sick.
Yeah.
I think for educators in particular, it's the most important job in America, in any country. Yeah. If only because, what is the greatest riches of a country? It's this future, and the future is the children. You know what our country is really in danger of? It's having a group of adults who inherit this country that we didn't invest in. whose creativity he stifled. So the idea that the person who chooses that career, that vocation, should have to suffer, should have to make choices between what they're going to eat and what they have, or if they're going to make, you know, they're going to print off materials or buy extra stuff for their kids. Like, that is sick. And it's the same thing for EMTs and everyone else too. I'm in the career field of education, so that's the one I get excited about.
But there's Jonathan, there is a reality of, you know, like service occupations. And I'm thinking a teacher, obviously, but I'm really familiar just because I live in a mountain town and my son was a ski patrol. You know, there are career ski patrol that can't afford to live within an hour of the place they work. And I'm just so curious about when you bump up against some of that reality, what do you do?
I don't know what anyone else should do. I'll tell you what I do. I say, first of all, it goes back to my extended family. We roll deep, right? To borrow a phrase, we roll deep. We stand together. And so number one, I don't worry about much. Even when, you know, living out in South Dakota, and I started the Liber Institute, and I didn't know if we would have traction. I knew deep in the recesses that if all else failed and this thing didn't go through, I knew that there was at least a couch that I could sleep on. Mm. There was somewhere I could go. And so I was never deterred from my purpose or what I felt like I was being called to do, because I had that safety net. And so I think that's the first thing you have to do. You have to know that family isn't just the people you're born with. It's the people that you choose along the way. And yeah, you have to be building family, and you have to be a caretaker, a steward of those relationships, right? And you have to be willing to do for others what you might need them to do for you in the future. So that's part of it. I think another part.
Hey, it's Carl. Now, it should be very clear at this point in the conversation that Jonathan is very passionate about what he does for a living. And I am really curious about this tension that sometimes exists between choosing something that you're passionate about and choosing something that you get paid well to do. And I loved where Jonathan went when I pushed him on this, was he reverted back to family and community. He felt a sense of safety to pursue this difference that he wanted to make in the world because he had this deep sense of safety that came from his community and his family. Now, I don't know the answer. I've been thinking about this passion situation, that's what I'm calling it these days, for a very long time. And I'm no closer to an answer, but I loved Jonathan's answer, that there were other areas in his life that made him feel safe and secure so he could pursue this thing that he felt called to do in the world.
In the future. So that's part of it. I think another part of it is, I heard the story recently about Henry Ford, and it's very different because he was not underpaid for what he did, right? Like, you know, he is probably a billionaire in today's money, you know, multi times over. But he was asked by Napoleon Hill if there was ever anything in life he didn't get that he wanted. And he thought about it, and then he said, no, that I ever wanted in life, I either got or I got a reasonable facsimile. And I laugh at the story, but I thought that the mindset that undergirded it was so powerful that I wanted to make it mine.
Huh.
This mental flexibility. When I do want something, I have to understand why I don't need to explain it to anyone else. Like I said to my son, you don't need to explain it, but I want to understand why I want it. What is it that I'm looking for? And being comfortable and flexible enough to say that what I initially am setting out for might not be the only way to get the thing I want.
Right.
And so I you know, want to travel. I want my kids to see the world, and they have seen a lot more of the world already than I did at that age. But I've also been flexible about the ways that they can encounter the world, because I still remember my mom telling me that my first passport was my library card. So even though now all four of my kids do have an actual passport, before that they all had a library card, right? And so getting them to understand it, and this is what I would encourage others. I would never encourage folks to stop advocating and fighting for better wages, right? You should, because you're entitled to it. When you do good work in a community, it should be rewarded. And at the same time, while you're advocating and pushing for those things, also, you know, challenging your own mindset around what is it that I want out of life? And are there other ways that I can get it, right? Because the other part of it is, like, if we get caught up thinking that all our wants are material, then we miss out on so many other things, right? Like when I want to buy that thing or I want to do that thing, if is it because I'm going to be entertained? Is it because I'm going to be enlightened? Is it because I'm going to be healthier? Okay. I don't like say I shouldn't want those things, but how else can I
express
experience enlightenment and joy and happiness and better health? Because either while I defer as I'm trying to get that thing, I don't want to sit here in this lack mindset while I'm pining for that thing. Not only am I not having that thing, but I'm giving up on the joy that I could experience in the moment, being grateful for what I do have. Joy is not a thing to be bought or to be earned. Joy is eternal. It is available in every moment. And so we have to be committed to choosing it in every moment. Whether I have a stack of money beside me or I have none, I can choose joy. And that makes the weight worth it. That makes the journey worth it. It makes the effort worth it, right? For that thing that you want or that achievement or that whatever that you're trying to get to. And it doesn't have to always be, it could be a relationship, right? But until you have it, you can still choose joy in the moment, joy for the journey, for the faculties to even pursue that thing.
Okay, my friends, this is so important that we need to talk about it. I want to just put a fine point on what Jonathan was just walking through, because I think there's actually a mental model that you can employ here that will be super helpful. At least it's been incredibly helpful for me. So if there's a thing that you want, right? Let's just use some crazy Instagram-y thing like a sailboat. If there's a thing that you want, the moment you notice that you want it, especially if it sticks around for a couple of days, right? You notice yourself thinking about it. You might have even mentioned to a spouse, a partner, a friend, hey, I think I want a sailboat. The moment you notice yourself wanting that, take these steps. Step number one, just ask yourself why, right? Why do I want the sailboat? Step number two, in your answer to why, look for expressions of values. So in the sailboat example, the first thing that came to my mind was the reason I'd want a sailboat is to spend time with my family, time with my friends, being outdoors, enjoying nature, and even adventure. So I'd have family, friends, outdoors, and adventure would be on my list for reasons I'd want a sailboat. Step number three, what ways could I express those values with what I already have today? Right? I could go on a walk with a friend. I could go skiing or hiking to get adventure. I can invite my friends or my family over for dinner in the apartment that I live in now. So if you take those three steps, rather than waiting for the day that you can buy the sailboat, you can actually start living in those values right now. Those three steps have been incredibly valuable for me, and I hope they're valuable for you. And with that, now's a really good time to take just a quick break. There's so much more to come of my conversation with Jonathan, so we'll be right back for the second half of the show. Hey, it's Carl. You know what's hard for most of us? Talking money. That's what I'm talking about. Talking about money is hard for most of us, but there's somebody who it is not hard for. She's been doing it forever. Her name is Shauna Game. And if you've been enjoying the conversations I'm having here at 50 Fires, I think you would love what Shauna's got going on at her podcast. The podcast is called Everyone's Talking Money. And just like 50 Fires, Shauna's goal with Everyone's Talking Money is to go beyond the spreadsheets and the calculators and the budgeting apps to talk about how our emotional relationship with money impacts our lives. With over 900 episodes, that's right, 900, there is an episode for any and every practical money question you have. Some of Shauna's recent episodes include retirement risks to avoid and credit card versus debit card. Which one should I use? You're going to love it. Subscribe to Everyone's Talking Money on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Welcome back to 50 Fires. Okay, so Jonathan, let's switch gears just a little bit and talk more about your experience with money. So to start, I'd love to back up. What was your earliest memory of money?
Oh my goodness. I don't know if I have like a specific earliest memory of money, but kind of like a theme in childhood around money was that we didn't have a lot of it, but I can honestly say that it didn't create in me the sense of, you know, profound lack or desire for things I couldn't have. Maybe it feels kind of contradictory, but there is at once this sense in my childhood of abundance. You know, there was a lot of love. There were a lot of adults around who cared for us. There was always food on the table. We always had clothes, but where the lack or the realization that we didn't necessarily have a lot of money was just, it wasn't always new clothes. You know, a lot of times it might've been hand-me-downs. And even that, like in a weird way, I'm one of seven. Both my parents are on their second marriage together. And so we're the three at the tail end. So I have older siblings, but they didn't always live with us. And so my hand-me-downs didn't come from an older brother. They came from my cousin, my two cousins who I thought were the coolest. So I was wearing hand-me-downs, but I thought I was, this is Titi's shirt or this is Robbie's shirt, you know? I thought that was cool. So anything, I feel like if I look back now, I can be pretty firmly say that I had everything I needed, you know, just not everything I wanted.
Yeah. You used an interesting word there that I'd love to just click on for a second, like lack. Mm-hmm. I love that word. Right. And just sort of exploring lack, but I don't know that it's ever come up in any of the conversations that we've had so far. So was that an intentional use of that word, or what do you think of when you think of lack?
When I think of the word lack, I think of, you know, something's missing, you know, not having something that either you've had or that you would like to have. And so, you know, to the point, we never lacked food. You know, now in hindsight, talking to my dad, I know that there were times he, you know, was watching and making sure there was enough and calculating if he was going to eat. But I never had to do that. You know what I mean? I never felt that as a child. I remember one time doing laundry with my brother, and this might be embarrassing to some folks or whatever, but I remember we're doing laundry and we were kind of like laughing at like how old some of my mother's stuff was, right? And it was kind of thread. We're like, what, man, mom needs a new this, whatever. And she told us, well, you know, I've hung on to those things to make sure that you guys had. And then we just felt, you know, so terrible because we were being silly, but it was like an early peek into the understanding I have now. I didn't fully get it, but they were making conscious decisions to ensure that we had the things we needed. And so we did not experience that lack. But as I got older, I became aware of it, where it existed or where it had existed. And it was right next to me, but I didn't always realize it.
Do you wish you would have known more as a child about that struggle?
I am glad I didn't know. My parents used to joke and say that I was like a little old man. Yeah, he's an old soul. And I think that if I had known, I might have worried for them, you know, for my parents. And it might have taken away from the magic of my childhood. You know, I think that having those memories unspoiled, you know, and just having this, like I thought, magical childhood. Like even when my dad was away working, he was a military, and then he would always have a second job. So sometimes he was away, but my grandfather and grandmother were downstairs. We lived in it was a three-decker. My grandparents owned it. We lived on the second floor. You know, there was a real tight orbit around my grandparents' house, you know? So my aunts and uncles and cousins were in and out of the house quite frequently. So for me, I grew up feeling like I was the center of the world. Not me specifically, but It was like if I living on the sun, right? Without being burnt. Like we are living in the center of the world. The whole galaxy rotates around on this axis. And so not knowing that we were, you know, just above struggling or just above broke or whatever, it allowed me to just have this magical childhood and all these memories. And so growing up, knowing what it means to be a father and a provider and a good partner and a good role model and a man and all these things unspoiled by, you know, a kid's fear of, well, if my parents are not eating, does that mean tomorrow we won't eat? Like I never had to worry about that. And so I'm glad I didn't know, but I'm also equally grateful that I do know it now. And then I'm gaining more and more perspective now.
That's incredible. How are you? I'm really interested in this idea of the extended family unit, because I think there's something really important there as it relates to this kind of like overhanging fear around having enough later in life. You're like, oh, I got to save for retirement. I got to like, and I don't know that it makes it easier, but I have this sense that that this unit, the family unit, and even maybe slightly larger than that, the community, how are you managing that with your kids? Like this whole thing of community, family. Well,
I definitely think that there is a lot lost in kind of like the American mythology of the nuclear family. Mm. Right? Like that's not really, at least in my experience, I have friends that I consider family from a very variety of religious traditions and ethnic backgrounds and races and communities and countries. And like the nuclear family is not really a big part of anyone's backstory. It's more, I don't know. I think, and I'm making a guess that it's a kind of like a new development in human history, like this idea of like the nuclear family. And when you think about it, right, like the idea that earlier societies were built around these, you know, these units of around 100, 150 people, small villages and stuff, it makes so much sense. This idea of like having, like we had this orbit around my grandparents' house and having aunts and uncles and cousins around. If anybody was struggling, there was this whole network of safety, people who loved you and were invested in you not failing and you not going hungry for too long, right? And even if it wasn't relatives, right? If you think about it as just a, you know, primitive village or something, it's important to me that you don't suffer and struggle, because if something happens to you and your family, that goes a piece of my safety net. So even if it's not like purely altruistic, there's at least a selfish piece of like, we need our community to thrive. And I had that, right? Like it was my relatives. And to kind of jump forward, right, to my time living on Pine Ridge in the Oglala Lakota community, they call that the Tioshpaye, the extended family, as we would call it in English. Mm. Like that's such a big part of a person's identity and our survival. It's better than a 401k, right? If you have like a whole family that is concerned about you. And so I think to that part, you said like, I got to save. There's like an anxiety attached to that, because at the same time that you're trying to save, and you know, maybe I have a relationship, you know, you're my financial planner and we can forecast the number I need to get to that comfortable level. But there are so many parts of that I can't control. I don't control inflation or economic factors or future wars that could happen that might make this all not valuable anymore. But if I have a Tioshpaye, if I have an extended family, that kind of hedges my bets in a whole totally different way.
We just spent a couple of years ago, we moved to New Zealand and we spent 4 years living over there. And we had a bunch of good friends from the Maori community. And in fact, the church we went to was largely Maori. And I noticed really quickly, I don't know, a 3-year-old during the church meeting would wander down the aisle. And I could never figure out whose kid it was, because all sorts of different aunties and uncles would grab it and pick it up and, you know, comfort it. And you could never figure out like, whose kid is this? And they had this phrase, whanau, which it sounds similar to the phrase that you were using. It was like they would just say like, we're all family. So like my goal quickly became, if I could just get the 16 and 17 year old kids that I hung out with at that church to call me uncle,
right?
You know, cause they were calling everybody else uncle. And it took me 4 years. I think I finally got one of them to say it, but I didn't like ask. I was just like, can I please remember that? So that idea was so beautiful to me of like, look, this is all of us. Like, and you'd commonly hear stories like, oh no, that's not my kid. She lives with me, but it's my brother's kid. And and she wanted to come live with us. And there's so much of that that, you know, obviously there's a hunger for that. I don't know that we recognize what the hunger is, but I think there's this hunger of community and connection that we're all missing. So I'm just sort of curious about what you've seen from your time in different Indigenous communities that points to this like sense of lack. You've obviously probably seen some real lack. And then on the other side, this sense of community and this like, that's almost like, I don't know, polarity between the two.
Right. Well, to that, what maybe second to last point, you know, that we have this profound desire that we maybe don't even recognize or have a name for.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought of this before, but I wonder if that isn't a part of the hole we try to fill in social media.
For sure. Right?
All those likes and things. It's like, it's the reinforcement. It's the love that I talked about that my aunts and uncles and my grandparents gave that I didn't have to wonder about. Those were my likes and my hearts and stuff. So I'd have to go looking for it everywhere else. My friends, you know, it was already there. That was my network. And so that's a really interesting point. As far as what I learned living on the res, I first went to Pine Ridge, which is in the southwestern corner of South Dakota, living among the Oglala Lakota people, which are part of what in our history books we'd call the Great Sioux Nation. So that was my first experience with Indigenous communities. And then from there, I have strong relationships now with folks in the Rosebud, on the Rosebud Reservation. We do a lot of our work there. I did some work at Standing Rock, and it's grown out even outside of South Dakota, but starting there. The same idea that you're talking about, like, I remember it wasn't a kid. It was a thing with grandmas. When people were talking about their grandmother passing and then they talk about another grandmother and then they had another grandma, I'm like, wait a minute. If your grandmother's dead but this is your grandmother, how is that your grandmother? And what I realized in the Lakota way, they don't do great aunt and great uncle, right? Like, so my parents are my kids' grandparents, but all of my aunts and uncles would also be their grandparents. And so when my students were talking about my grandmother, my other grandmother, these are all maybe their aunts, their great aunts and great uncles in the way that we would talk about it, which, grandma and grandpa sound a lot closer than great aunt and great uncle, right? It's just, and so this idea that there's a bunch of grandmas and grandpas who are watching out for me. If it's not working out at home, I have all these other places that I can go. We see a lot of families doubling up on the reservation. Families living with other parts of their family. And so, for me, it was I learned it very quickly, very early on that like that nuclear family thing wasn't a big deal on the res. Nobody was talking, when they talk about family, they're not talking about 5 or 6 people. They're talking about maybe 10 or 15 people living in the same trailer. It could be multiple parent sets and their kids or a grandmother and multiple kids from, different home, And so, yes, there was a, very clear images of lack in that, poverty porn is like the most prevalent thing you'll see about life on the res, right? It's like the one people love to, for whatever reason, promote that. And, look at these poor kids and look at these poor families and look at all this lack. And what they won't show you is that, yes, materially, there may be things that my kids were struggling with at home and things they didn't have, but there was so many beautiful examples of generosity. The folks that you might look down your nose at and think, they live in that. That's where they live, would be the ones who would generously pull out food to feed you and to make sure you didn't go hungry, right? Like, this is something that I've seen so many times on the reservation, folks pulling together, drawing together to make sure that another family didn't go without, or someone's kids didn't go without. When I was, so I worked at Little Wound School, which is named after Chief Little Wound. At Little Wound School, man, every season kids would get, t-shirts, Little Wound t-shirts or swag, hoodie. And I'm thinking, man, all this money the school spends on swag, like what in the world? You learn that yes, it's so that, kids can have the colors and be part of the community and celebrate at the games. But low key, it was really about making sure that even the kid didn't have any other clothes, they would have clothes to come to school. So the school even contributing to make sure that the kids had enough clothes. having breakfast at school, having lunch at school, having a bag lunch to go home with kids on the bus home if they were playing sports so they would not miss dinner. You know, so that even the school as a relative, which, so, you know, when you're talking about your Maori relatives being so thoughtful about each other, it really resonates because it's what I saw. It's what I experienced as a kid, but then it's definitely what I saw as a community member living on Pine Ridge, was that the school, not only school making sure kids had clothes and food, but around the holidays, because, you know, a lot of the kids, even if they kept to traditional spiritual ways, Christmas, you know, Christmas now in the United States is ubiquitous. It's everywhere. Everybody does it, right? It doesn't have to, you know, it could be Santa. Maybe it's not Christ. Maybe it's just Santa, but everybody knows what Christmas is. So the school making sure kids had gifts at Christmas time. They might be more swag, but making sure that they had something to open like this. And so, you know, Pine Ridge, at any given time, some of the poorest counties in the United States, they're going to be, a lot of them are going to be reservation communities. And one or two or three of them are going to be in South Dakota. It's just the reality. It has been that way historically anyway. So it might be Pine Ridge. It might be, it used to be called Shannon County. So Oglala Lakota County. It might be Todd County, which is on Rosebud. It might be, I forget what they call it in Standing Rock, but you're going to find that some of the poorest people in the country live in these communities. And it's not just there, right? Because there are other reservation and Pueblo communities that would also probably be on that list. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you're going to see so many beautiful examples of generosity of people who are giving from what you perceive as, how can you give when you don't have anything? Why wouldn't you keep that? Right. And so those are some of the lessons that I learned about, you know, what is the value of money if you're hoarding it? It doesn't mean anything if you're hoarding it, but if you're moving it through your community to make sure that folks are taken care of, then it has value. That has great value then.
Yeah, Jonathan, that's super interesting. We just spent some time, as we occasionally do, down on the Navajo reservation. And this last trip was really interesting to me because the gentleman that we stayed with has been there forever, and his grandparents and has a real deep connection to the land, lives out on a dirt road, and like the whole story you would imagine, was telling us about, you know, electricity and plumbing and all those things. But then proceeded to tell us about how he's seeing a lot of the college graduate kids coming back, you know, and because they want something, and the pandemic even made it more clear to them, there's something there that they couldn't get elsewhere, right? Like they couldn't be replaced. And I think you're pointing, I mean, I wouldn't know exactly what it was, but he was pointing to this sense of community connection to grandparents and great grandparents, and this sense that you've got each other's sort of back. And it, you know, one thing that this reminds me of, a lot of the anxiety that I see around money, and sometimes it just takes zooming out, like going to New Zealand or 4 hours from my house, to get a different perspective. But one of the things I think that's causing a lot of trouble is there's been this shift from collective systems to individual systems, you know, all the way from what you're pointing to, like this idea of small village, group, community that we got maybe in our village, we may have gotten in our church, even like the collective savings for a later day we used to call a pension.
Right.
And now we've shifted to a 401k where if I don't put the money away, it's not going to be there. And I'm not saying necessarily it's a bad thing, but one of the consequences of it has been like this rugged individualism, you know, this idea like I did it, or if I don't do it, no one will. And then another consequence is like this fear of being left alone, you know, at age 65 or 70, whereas there used to be this collective community that valued you, and you it wasn't just pity, it wasn't, but you were actually valued for the wisdom that you brought back to the group. So you no longer were the strong person out doing the work, but the strong people out doing the work could come to you and say, hey, how do I do this better, right? And there are some problems that are just frankly only going to be solved collectively, you know, or at least best solved collectively,
I just want to touch on what you were saying, because I think I might have mentioned this mythology making that, you know, around the nuclear family. It's a big theme in how I see America right now, the United States. We are such a, relatively speaking, a young country. It's like we're still trying to make our myths. And one of them, you know, was it Paul Bunyan and John Henry? And one of them is this rugged individual.
Yeah.
It's this idea that America was a bunch of individuals who built this great place. And it's so ahistoric, and it does us a disservice. And it does a disservice to the idea of the Teochpayeh, if we want to use the Lakota word, or the extended family, right? Even if we don't get into all the details, right? There's settlers didn't come here and then individually go build America. Even that, the colonies were groups and villages, right? From the inception, and they met people in villages, the native folks, right? So this has always been groups of people coming together and creating and building. And so to flash forward to the year 2024, where everyone is self-made, like even literally that, I hate that phrase, because even literally it makes no sense. Nobody's self-made, right? You didn't birth yourself. You didn't deliver yourself. You didn't slap yourself on the bottom, right? Like there are so many people and so many folks that you're related to, as well as folks you will never know, who had to be complicit in your arrival. And so it's such a horrible metaphor, this idea that, well, maybe it's ideal, because it's as likely that you are a self-made millionaire as you are a self-made person, meaning it's 0% likely. So many people.
I can't help myself but jump in here. I love this view that Jonathan has, and you can feel him continually going back to it. This deep sense of value that he gets from family and community. And one thing to note, like this is pretty settled doctrine at this point, that connection, community, friendship, that is the thing that we value most as humans. It's one of the things that people most often point to near the end of their lives. And to think about all the people along the way that helped me get where I am today. I was actually just thinking about Mr. Bessie, my English teacher, when I was a sophomore in high school. And did I not like English. I didn't like school, period. And somehow Mr. Bessie, with this insane level of discipline and at the same time interest, it was one of my favorite classes I ever took. And I would have never, ever anticipated that from an English class. Well, it turned out that I'm an author. And I think often about Mr. Bessie and the impact he made for me. And Fred Oswald, my soccer coach, my teacher at community college that taught my English class and made me write my paper 7 times over. And I still have a copy of that paper, right? My economics teacher at Utah Valley Community College, who would draw on a whiteboard with 7 different markers. Well, I often wonder about the origin of the sketches because of that experience with that teacher. So it's so interesting to reflect back on the tapestry of people that make us who we are. And I love Jonathan pointing us to that. Likely.
So many people, your parents, your teachers, your siblings, your friends, your business partners had to be complicit in your success. In a good way, right? They had to co-conspire with you for you to become the successful man or woman or person that you are now. Even if we think about the worst parts of our history, right? Like slavery, for example, right? When we don't teach it, not only do we ignore our sins, but we also fail to celebrate the people who were complicit in enslaved people working out their freedom. Yes, Black people had to fight for their freedom. They were at the front of that, but there were also white people who fought with them. And so if we don't tell that story the true way, we miss out those heroes. And you can look at that at every level, at every civil rights, you know, women's rights, the American Indian movement, all these periods of time when we were trying to repair harm done, they were always the folks who were most impacted, but they were in community with others who were like, you know what? They're right. This is wrong. We've got to fix it. And so when we tell the story of rugged individuals or people doing it, working it out alone, we miss out the ability to tell an even better American story, which has always ideally been this tapestry of people from all different walks of life. Yes, there were bad things that happened, but the best part of us is when we acknowledged those bad things and we went together to fix it.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, Jonathan, I mean, I don't know about you, but I feel like we could spend hours together.
Right.
Well, let's wrap up with one last question.
Sure.
Let's say that 30 years from now, I'm still doing this show and your six-year-old son is on and I ask him, why is money important to you? What would you hope he would say? Like, what would you hope he would say about money and meaning in his life?
I would hope he would say that money is only important to him in so much as it is an expression of the value that he brings into the world, right? Like he might say, you know, the money that I have, the money that I earn is a reflection of my commitment to finding what is something that you can offer the world. Further, what it allows him to do is to experience the freedoms that his dad used to talk about, right? Like I can take the trips with my own kids and my grandkids the way I want to. I get to enjoy the things with my partner that I want to enjoy. I get to see the places that I want to see and do the things I want to do. So there's like that freedom of money. I get to spend time with people that I want to spend time with, which is the freedom of association. I get to do work with people that I enjoy working with. The time piece, right? Like I don't do things I don't want to do. Everything I do because I want to do it, because I love doing it. You know, it may not be fun always, right? Like maybe some of, you know, like, and this is him and this is also me talking, right? Some of the things I do, I don't like, but what they represent, I love, right? They represent me supporting my kids or supporting my wife or, you know, whatever it may be, or creating the means for them to live the life that I believe that they deserve and that they want, right? So I may not like everything, but I love it all. And then he would hopefully say that, and then that he gets to live out his purpose. You know, he's 36 now. And so he spent most of his 36 years in pursuit of and doing the things that he really loves to do and that he feels God made him to do. Not just him, but his sister and his brothers. That's what we're taking forward, what my dad and my mom did for us for the next generation, right? And so money's just a part of it. Money is a tool. It is a means, but it's not the goal. It has never been and it won't ever be. If he says that, boy, I will be the proudest 70-year-old guy. You know, I'll be listening riveted and I will be so proud. I probably have tears coming out of my eyes.
Yeah, me too. Amen, brother. That was so fun.
Cool, man. Me too, man. This is so fun.
Yeah. Thank you. You know what's going through my head? It's a question. The question is, what do we choose to invest in? And why? I think the definition of real financial planning is the alignment of your use of capital. And whenever I say capital, there's a little asterisk next to it. The asterisk says time, money, energy, and attention. So really, it's the alignment of these four sources of capital, time, money, energy, and attention, with what's important to you. You know, if you were to think about that as a Venn diagram, like one circle would be use of capital with the asterisk, and the other circle would be what's important to you. And our goal, of course, is to get those to be perfectly overlapping. Now, you're never finished with that, just by the way. Like it's sort of this dynamic Venn diagram where sometimes the circles aren't even touching. There's this gap between what we say is important to us and our use of time, money, energy, or attention. And the more active we can be in engaging in that process, the more fulfilling we'll find our lives. And I think what I took away from this conversation was thinking carefully, like, what do I choose to invest my time in? Who do I want to spend it with? What do I choose to invest my attention or energy or money? And one of the things that's clear from the conversation with Jonathan is that one of the places that I know I can reliably, and again, if we're using the language of money, I can reliably get a return on my investment is by investing in my community, my family, and the extended community. Because the things that we'll remember, right, when we reflect back on our lives, we'll remember the soccer team that we coached. We'll remember the walk to the mailbox while holding hands with your spouse. will remember the time skipping rocks at the lake with your son. Those are the sorts of things we remember. And in fact, those are the places that we can reliably count on to provide us with safety and security. Almost everything else can feel transient. But those relationships, those are worth investing in. I'm really glad that you joined me today for this conversation with Jonathan. Until next time, cheers, my friends. 50 Fires is a production of Blind Nil Audio in association with The Roost. If you find this show valuable, and I sure hope you do, please share it with a friend and leave a 6 or 7 or maybe even 8-star review over on Apple Podcasts. It's crazy how much that helps the show get introduced to more people. Speaking of more people, I have a goal that we can use 50 Fires as a spark to start 1 million conversations a month about money. I've heard from so many of you about the conversations you're having around the dinner table, on a road trip in the car, or at your favorite coffee shop, and I think we need more. So if you've got a friend or a family member that you think would benefit from having a conversation about money, or if you happen to give advice for a living, we've created a whole set of free resources. Think of it as a book club about money. It's over at 50fires.com, and you can use it every week. We're updating it every week so that you can help me start 1 million conversations a month about money. I'm looking forward to our next conversation around the fire. Cheers, my friends.
The views, information, or opinions expressed in this series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of Chip and Joanna Gaines, Blind Nil Audio, nor Magnolia.